We Believe. We're on the sixth part of this series, and you know, it's kind of funny to just kind of stop and think about all the things that could be said, let alone maybe the things that should be said on the topic of apologetics. Realistically, and we kind of referred to this on the first day that we started talking about this topic, apologetics is a part of our everyday lives as Christians. We're challenged on many fronts on a very constant basis. If we have the radio on, we need to be able to make a defense at the very least on our own mind, or the television, or if we're reading the newspaper or magazines, or if we're talking to people, things come up all the time that we need to have some sort of a ready response to. It's an everyday part of living in a non-Christian world that we need to defend the faith that we hold, the hope that we have, at least to ourselves in many circumstances, and very often to other people. I'm going to begin this morning with a story from the book of Judges. Judges chapter 9, verses 50 through 53, actually just a little blurb from a story, a little excerpt from the man who would be king, Abimelech, in the story of Judges, the son of Gideon, who tried to make himself king of Israel, ruled over a small area of Israel for a time, and then had a falling out with those people who had conspired with him to murder his brothers and place him in that position of power. Judges 9, 50 through 53. Next, Abimelech went to Thebez and besieged it and captured it. Now, this was his own people. These were people who had been among his followers previously. Inside the city, however, was a strong tower to which all the men and women, all the people of the city, fled. They locked themselves in and climbed up on the tower roof. Abimelech went to the tower and stormed it, but as he approached the entrance to the tower to set it on fire, a woman dropped an upper millstone on his head and cracked his skull. 2 Samuel 11 and 21, who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal? Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebez? Why did you get so close to the wall? If he asks you this, then say to him, also your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead. That reference is from the story of King David ordering Joab to arrange for the death in battle of Uriah the Hittite. And when Uriah the Hittite was killed after being abandoned close to the city wall where the battle was taking place, Joab told the messenger who went to tell David about a bad day in the battle, that when David objects, why were you so close to the wall? Don't you know the story of Abimelech and how a woman threw an upper millstone and killed him? Why would you be so close to the wall? That time David should be told, Uriah the Hittite is dead, which would set David's mind at ease. There had been a reason to be so close to the wall. Well, we're not going to get into the details of either of those stories. I just wanted to notice that bit about a millstone being up on the roof of a tower and a woman throwing the millstone to kill the pretender king Abimelech, the man who would be king. The notion, this is from Susan Ackerman, a much published Bible scholar, feminist Bible scholar, and a woman whom I had the opportunity to hear a few years ago at a seminar that I attended. The notion that a millstone is even present at the top of a tower is at least a highly unrealistic detail, she wrote, in Warrior, Dancer, Seductress, Queen in 1998. The idea that a woman would be able to throw a millstone from the top of a tower, or even that a millstone was at the top of a tower, Susan Ackerman wrote, is at least a highly unrealistic detail. And then from Robert G. Bowling, Judges Introduction, Translation, and Commentary in the Anchor Bible Series, which is supposed to be one of the most scholarly commentary series of our time, that author wrote, she must have dropped it and probably had help, as a single individual could hardly have managed to throw one. And yet, that's exactly how David, or how Joab described the event, a woman threw an upper millstone from the roof of the tower. The story of the woman of Thebez who killed Abimelech echoes the mythological story of Anat, the Canaanite goddess, wrote Lila Leah Bonner in A Feminist Companion to Judges in 1993. And by the way, there are quite a number of published feminist authors who are de-scrambling the Bible and reimagining the contents, reinterpreting the writings of the Bible from a feminist perspective. The woman is described as an Amazon, and the story of her throwing the millstone as hyperbole, again in the Anchor Bible Commentary on that subject. Well, it would be quite a feat, wouldn't it, to carry an upper millstone up on top of a tower and throw that millstone off. This is an illustration from a children's Bible storybook type of document. Who would the character be that's on the screen there? Samson, toiling, laboring, pushing the heavy grindstone around in a circle day by day as he labored in the Philistine prison. We're going to transition to an article that was in the Biblical Archaeology Review, which is not especially a Bible-friendly magazine. It's not especially a magazine that upholds the Bible as inerrant and inspired. An article from this magazine in 2002, a watermelon named Abimelech. The woman hefted the black basalt grinding stone. She squinted into the sunshine and made out the round form of Abimelech on the rampart. She took aim and hurled the stone straight at him. Red gore splattered as it found its mark. A shout went up from the watchers on the city walls and the rooftop. Victory was theirs. This article was written by a couple of professors, Denise Hare and Mary Boyd. From that same article, to prove our point and vindicate the woman of Thebes, we held a millstone throwing contest. They had read all of their, they were at a dig, okay? They were at a dig over in Israel. And they had read the various analyses of the story of the woman of Thebes saying that they wouldn't have very likely had a millstone up on the rooftop, and a woman couldn't possibly have lifted it and thrown it anyway without help, and so on and so on and so on. And they thought, well, you know, this is really rather denigrating to women to talk about this woman in this way, that it had to be mythological, it had to be an adaptation of an Egyptian myth of Anat and her heroic strength, that it had to be hyperbole, exaggeration, and so on and so forth. And so they wanted to put this idea to the test, and to prove our point and vindicate the woman of Thebes, we held a millstone throwing contest. We were successful. The first participant, Gina, hit Abimelech dead on. But notice the millstones that they're holding. Can you tell in the picture there, as poor as the resolution is, what kind of millstones they're holding? This isn't something that that you're going to have a donkey to pull around in a circle, is it? This millstone, this grindstone, is something that you hold in two hands to use, but it only weighs 6 or 8 pounds. It's not a huge thing. There's a picture on the screen now of the women on the wall throwing a millstone at a man down below, but they're not really throwing a millstone. If you look down at the feet of the man, there's a smashed mess that used to be the watermelon that they were actually throwing at. Unfortunately, the very first woman who threw the very first millstone hit the watermelon and broke it, so there wasn't a lot of fun in that. They smashed it on the first try, and so one of the dig leaders stood down below, and they made a bundle out of foam rubber and cloth and wrapped it with tape and threw the bundle at him in order to carry through. Thus the woman of Thebes was vindicated from her detractors. Not only could she have thrown the stone, she could have easily killed the enemy. Why then do scholars of both genders, and feminists at that, belittle her feat by saying it is unlikely or hyperbolic? The answer is that some Bible scholars do not know the archaeological record well enough to make correct assumptions. Now, one of the things that we could know, if we would bother to find out, is the kind of millstone that they were visualizing and saying that a woman couldn't have done it didn't come on the scene for a long time after the period of the judges. Many other recent sources, several of them feminists, suggest the woman of Thebes must have dropped the millstone. Oddly, the 1985 revised edition of the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, the ISBE, got this wrong in the article Millstone by C.G. Rasmussen, even though the old 1915 edition article had it right. In 1985, when they updated the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, the author of that article said that this could not have happened as described in Judges, that a woman would not have been able to pick up a millstone and throw it at a man on the ramparts down below. But in the old article, 70 years before, Blisson McAllister, looking at archaeological excavations going on in their day, at that time, 70 years earlier, Blisson McAllister and their excavations at Geezer and other places have found specimens of what is called the saddle quern or mill, which consists of two stones. The nether stone, always made of hard lava or basalt from the district of the Haran, was a large heavy slab varying in length from 1.5 feet to 2 3/4 feet and in width from 10 inches to 1 1/3 feet. Its upper surface was hollowed out slightly, which made it look a little like a saddle, and may have suggested the name of writing millstone applied by the Hebrews to the upper stone which rested on it, and then a reference to the story there in Judges 9:53, where the woman of Thebez brained Abimelech. The upper stone or rider was much smaller, 4 inches to 8 inches long and 2 3/4 inches to 6 inches wide, and of varying shapes. They knew that in 1915 when that article was written. Why didn't the scholar who wrote the article in 1985 know that? Why didn't he read the original article before he wrote his article? Why didn't he check with archaeological sources before he made his assumptions? Well, because he thought he knew. Because he thought he knew. He'd already come to his conclusions. He already had his presuppositions. And we need to realize and understand, and I've kind of beaten this horse to death already, that very often people do not come looking for facts to figure things out. They come with pre-existing conclusions and make their statements and assertions based on that, and that certainly happens in the area of Bible scholarship. Judges 16:21, then the Philistine seized Samson, gouged out his eyes, and took him down to Gaza, binding him with bronze shackles. They set him to grinding in the prison. The children's illustration that I had up earlier, or this woodcut, this drawing from several years ago, picturing Samson chained to a beam and dragging a huge stone around to grind the grain. Unfortunately, those kinds of stones did not exist for 1,000 years after that. And yet it's commonly pictured that way. The grinding with handmills, this grinding with handmill stones being the employment of menials, Samson was set to it as the deepest degradation. Samson, in the description of the bronze shackles that he was imprisoned with, it describes, the word there actually refers to double shackles, and so he had shackles on both hands and feet. He wasn't getting up and dragging a huge stone. He was sitting there, unable to walk, unable to do much of anything, bound hand and foot, grinding with a stone. The most menial and boring of labors, usually assigned to second-class citizens like women and children. And this was the status that Samson was reduced to. Well, it's easy enough to have the wrong idea because, you know, the idea of a circular grindstone of a large mill came into vogue in centuries much later than the Abimelech story, much later than the Samson story. And it's easy to understand why painters, artists would get that wrong, because painters, artists tend to picture what they know, tend to put that into the frame of reference of the ancient. And if you look at pictures from the Middle Ages relating to Bible stories, the characters look like medieval characters. They don't look like characters appropriately garbed or appropriately equipped with the times that would have been appropriate. The Bible, on the other hand, with its verbal pictures, it doesn't make those kinds of mistakes. It doesn't get the story wrong. It gets the story right. Very often later detractors get the story wrong because they come with pre-existing notions, including scholars who ought to know better. Scholars who have made a point of studying the book of Judges in excruciating detail in order to extract their own particular political agenda from that book, in many respects, or from other portions of the Bible, coming with preconceived ideas about the technology that existed. You know, there was a reference, and I never talked about it the other day in the context of Noah's Ark, that they couldn't have built the Ark with the existing technology. The problem with that statement, which I didn't touch on at all, was that we have no idea what pre-flood technology was. We know that in the account of Cain's lineage, if we accept the Bible as being true, and I do, we have a picture of within 7 generations of coming to all kinds of technological achievements, including the development of sophisticated musical instruments and metallurgy and herding techniques and things like that in the lineage of Cain. But we have no idea what the technology was in the day of Noah. What were they capable of doing technologically? Well, the assumptions that are assigned to Noah are that you go back to a primitive period of the modern record, the record that we are able to examine with a little more fortitude, a little more capacity, and you assume that Noah had that kind of technology. But I really believe that when Noah and his sons came off of the ark, they were able to preserve some of what they had known in the old world, but not by any means all of it, that they had to start over in many respects behind the curve of the previous accomplishments of humankind. It's another story, a story from a previous day, but it relates to the fact that very often people looking back at the past make assumptions that are simply unwarranted, including scholars who write commentaries, scholars who write books of analysis about the Bible. Very often we have presumptions that simply do not stand up if we look at the record, and yet the Bible stands up very well. I used the story of the woman of Thebes as an illustration of the kind of evidence we're going to be thinking mostly about today, which is circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence can be very compelling when it is consistent with the information that we have pictured in the stories of the Bible. The story of the woman of Thebes is not a biblical myth. It's a modern anachronism. When the scholars and the critics look at that story and say, well, this couldn't have been done. Actually, they're totally wrong. Not only could there have been a millstone on an upper story, on a roof of a building, but in fact, there have been examples of that very thing found in situ, in place, in archaeological sites. Why would they go up on the roof to grind their grain? Well, because it was a place that was uncluttered, open to the air, cool, where you could sit in the peace of the evening and grind your grain without a lot of interference. But the coolness and the movement of air was an important factor in that. And we know, in fact, that they used grindstones on the upper story. You know, the law forbade taking an upper millstone as a pledge. You couldn't take someone's upper millstone as a pledge. They're not talking about some big grinding weight. They're talking about something you'd take in your hand and carry away, but something that was vital for everyday consumption, something that you needed every day to prepare your daily bread, because whole grain keeps and ground flour doesn't, unless it's been treated, you know, like the stuff that we buy in the store. Ground flour doesn't really keep very well, and so you don't grind a whole lot of it at once. You grind it in small portions and you use it up day by day or a few days at a time. The biblical story is completely consistent with the technology of the period of the judges in the 12th century BC or thereabouts, and completely consistent with what we know as fact. The story is completely credible. The story of the woman of Thebes killing Abimelech, like most stories of the Old Testament, has been labeled impossible, ridiculous, myth, retold myth, exaggeration, hyperbole, etc., by modern scholars who don't have the available facts straight. The available facts would tell them otherwise, but they don't even have the available facts straight, but assume their assumptions are sufficient basis for their assertions. Archaeology and experimentation affirm what we've known for centuries, that the biblical story is completely credible and accurately depicts the time frame in which it is pictured as occurring. In talking about archaeology, it's always important to remember, and this is something that's stated in most archaeology classes at one point or another, that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. The fact that you cannot find something in the archaeological remains doesn't mean it never existed. The fact that you don't find independent records of a character doesn't mean that character never existed. You cannot argue from silence in the area of archaeology. How much do we expect to recover from the distant past in areas where there had been continual habitation, for example, and layer upon layer upon layer of human dwellings built over pre-existing remains from older civilizations? In recent years, this is from an article by Israel Finkelstein and Avraham Perevolotsky, which was also in Biblical Archaeology Review in 1985. In recent years, archaeological research in the Sinai Peninsula has burgeoned as never before. Intensive surveys and excavations have been carried out in all regions of the peninsula, and what was once a remote and mysterious region has become, archaeologically speaking, well known and relatively understood. And that definitely doesn't mean they've gone over every square inch. Far, far from that. But it has been relatively well explored, relatively understood, archaeologically speaking. The Sinai Peninsula, that region that lies between Egypt and Israel and the southern portion of that region. All this archaeological activity, however, as Finkelstein said, has contributed almost nothing to our understanding of the Exodus. This is true despite the fact that the Bible describes the wanderings of the Israelites at great length and even provides us with a long list of place names where the children of Israel encamped during their wanderings in Numbers 33. And that list, by the way, is a very reasonable, intelligent list that can be corroborated at several points as being actual locations, but not in all points. But so far, no remains from the late Bronze Age, 15th to 13th centuries BC, the period in which these events were supposed to have taken place, or even from the subsequent Iron Age I, have been found anywhere in the whole Sinai Peninsula, except for archaeological evidence of Egyptian activity on Sinai's northern coastal strip. Accordingly, no progress has been made in locating the Israelite encampments, in identifying their route, or in fixing the site of Mount Sinai. Archaeology isn't telling us anything about the Exodus account. Well, maybe not. There's actually a couple problems with the position that Finkelstein and his co-writer here take. One of those problems is we don't really know for absolutely certain where Mount Sinai is. I mean, you'll find it on any map of that region that you look at, but We don't really know for sure just where Mount Sinai is, and there's some controversy about that, and it's a controversy that involves actually quite a range of distance between some of the mountains that are suggested as possible locations of Sinai. Now, they knew where Sinai was all through the Old Testament period, and Paul knew where Sinai was and made reference to Mount Sinai in Arabia in his time. But then we had this big upheaval that took place in 70 AD when the Romans conquered Jerusalem, and then 50 years came back and conquered it again in the Second Jewish Revolt. And the second time, they really ran the Jews out of the area. They banned Jews from living in what had been the city of Jerusalem and became Aulia Capitolina, a Roman city in which no Jew was allowed. And during that intervening period of time, some of the things that had been well known before weren't so well known afterward, and there was a lot of damage done to what would have remained of ancient sites, including the tombs of the kings that had been well known up until the first century. Peter could confidently say to his hearers at Pentecost, you know, we have the tomb of David. Well, if you visit Jerusalem today, you'll be introduced to something that's called the tomb of David, but it's certainly not the tomb of David. The tomb of David has been missing and unaccounted for, at least since the second century, when the Romans conquered that city for the second time. And a Roman writer of the period makes reference to the mysterious collapse of the tombs of the Israelite kings, which is to say the Romans purposefully eliminated those kinds of landmarks in the city of Jerusalem. They didn't want that kind of Jewish presence in the city of Jerusalem. And during that time period, knowledge of some of the well-known things of the past became a little more ethereal, a little more uncertain, including the location of Mount Sinai. And so we come into the 4th century and the great fascination that Helena, the mother of Constantine, had for relics and things relating to the sacred past. And we have an effort to kind of recover some of the past, figure out where Jesus was buried, figure out where Jesus was born, you know, assign all these things. And some of it could be reasonably well established, and some of it was just pure guesswork. But it was nevertheless confidently asserted, whether it was pure guesswork or well established in that day, as so much of scholarship has an unfortunate tendency to be today as well. And then in the years that followed, in the medieval period, there is an assignment of a location of Mount Sinai where St. Catherine's Monastery is built, and that area is the traditional, now traditional, location of Sinai. But it's not at all certain that that was the original location that the Israelites came to. So when it comes to looking for archaeological remains, we have a problem in that area. I think we have another problem in looking for archaeological remains of the Israelites, and what Moses summed up regarding the Israelite journey, the 40 years of their journeying, and in spite of what Finkelstein and his co-writer said here about having this great record, actually the entirety of our record of the 40 years of wilderness wandering is contained in the chapters of Numbers from 15, where God has pronounced the penalty that they're going to spend a year for every day that the spies had been in the land of Canaan. Over the next dozen chapters, we have the whole account, really, of their wanderings, and then all of a sudden, we're at the end of the story. They're fighting the people on the verge of Jordan, getting ready to cross over into the land, and we know almost nothing when all is said and done. We have a list of places there in Numbers 33. But as far as stories of the wilderness wanderings, we have almost nothing of that period of time, the 38 years that lie between the departure from Sinai and being there on the verge of Jordan, fighting with Og, king of Bashan, and others there, and preparing to enter into the land. The Bible tells us very little. That doesn't mean there was never very much written. There was the book of the wars of the Lord that we don't have anymore, and the book of Jasher that we don't have anymore. That doesn't mean that they didn't know about it way back when, but we don't have much about that anymore, and I don't think God considered it important for us to have a blow-by-blow recounting of the wilderness wandering. So there's a lot that we really don't know about that, and a lot that really can't be demonstrated about it. But Moses did say something kind of peculiar to the Israelites, or at least it sounds peculiar to my ear, when he reminds them that during the years of their wandering, when he's giving his speeches to the people there, the three speeches in the book of Deuteronomy, and he says that during all those years, your feet didn't swell and your shoes didn't wear out. And that suggests to me that through the providence of God, the same providence that provided the manna day after day after day, 6 days a week, but not seven, the manna that wouldn't keep 6 days a week, but would keep on the seventh, the same providence of God that supplied that manna provided them with a material culture that seemingly wouldn't leave very much behind. If they weren't wearing out shoes, I take it they probably weren't wearing out a lot of other things either, because this was an interval. They left Egypt prepared to spend a short time in the desert and then go into the land of Canaan. That short time turned into a whole generation. And during that interval, God was exhibiting special guidance and special care, special provision for his people. And I don't think they would have left a lot of artifacts, per se, behind. Nevertheless, there is a lot of discussion about possible locations of Mount Sinai. There's a location utterly different than the traditional location that seems to have been a very important site to somebody in ancient history as far as religious rituals is concerned, but we don't really know for sure where Mount Sinai is. Absence of evidence, not finding relics of Israel in the Sinai Peninsula, may mean they didn't actually spend a lot of time in the peninsula itself, or it may mean that God in his providence was taking care of them, or it may mean none of those things, simply that we haven't found what's there yet. But absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. The fact that we don't have much to demonstrate the Exodus doesn't mean that it didn't happen. But we do know that the story of the Exodus is credible, just like the story of the woman of Thebes is credible. It makes sense in the context of the time frame in which it is pictured. Now, there were Asiatic slaves in Egypt, and Asiatic is a word that the Egyptians used to describe the Israelite people, as well as other people who came from that region of the Levant and up through into the area that we would call Asia today. There were Asiatic slaves in Egypt making bricks in the right time frame. If you look at the lower panel of the picture that's up on the screen, you have a picture of people who are carrying mud, you have a picture of people who are mixing mud and packing bricks, you have a picture that shows Egyptian overlords with sticks, with rods in their hand to enforce the work of the slaves. And this is not in the tomb of a pharaoh, this is in the tomb of a vizier who served under a pharaoh in about the 14th or 15th century BC, somewhere in that time frame, which is consistent with the story the Bible tells us about what the Egyptians were doing. Does this prove the Israelites were slaves in Egypt? No, but it's consistent with what the Bible says about the role of the Israelites in Egypt. And again, the story is shown to be credible. When we look at, and I hope you don't find the idea disturbing, but when we look at the material culture that is described in the book of Exodus, the things that the Israelites were to make, those things are also consistent with their origin at that point in time and with the time frame in which they lived. When I had the chance to go with a Tom Dennis tour group to Egypt several years ago, and we visited some Egyptian sites, you would see things that looked a lot like the Ark of the Covenant. Not the same. I mean, the idolatrous difference was clear, and yet you would see things that looked a lot like the Ark of the Covenant that had rings in their side for poles to be thrust through and to carry them on the soldiers. They had religious reliquaries of their own, the Egyptians did, which were reminiscent of what Israel made in the desert at that point in time. If you look at the funerary equipment that was buried with King Tut in his tomb, you would see a structure that is reminiscent of the tabernacle with gold covering, gold foil over the entire structure, a portable, movable structure that could be used for worship purposes. Now, I hope that it's not disturbing to think that the Egyptians were doing similar kinds of things. After all, the Israelites came out of Egypt. This is things that they would be familiar with. They had people who were trained in the kinds of arts and crafts that were necessary to produce this kind of equipment. And this kind of equipment, the Ark of the Covenant, the Tabernacle, and other appurtenances thereof, are consistent with the time frame of the mid-second millennium BC. They're not consistent with the time frame in which later scholars of the past 150 years would suggest the Exodus account was written. The Tabernacle doesn't make very much sense if that was all written down in the 6th century BC or the 5th century BC or anywhere in that kind of time frame. But it makes a great deal of sense if it was written down in the 15th century BC, in the time when the Israelites are pictured as coming out of the land of Egypt. And when it comes to these kind of similarities, you could do the same kind of comparison with the temple that Solomon built. The temple that Solomon built is very consistent with other temples that we find in the same time frame, temples that were built by the Phoenicians in other locations, and we know the Phoenicians had artisans that were employed by Solomon in the building of the temple. That this is very consistent, the kind of structure that he built, the kind of architecture involved, is very consistent with the architecture of sacred buildings in the time frame in which Solomon lived, which helps us to conclude, or should help us to conclude, that we have an accurate accounting of what those people did in the time frame in which the Bible reports them as doing it. Does that mean, as we talked about Tuesday in regard to mythology, if the Israelites are building something similar to something that Egyptians were building, does that mean they got their ideas from the Egyptians? No. It means God used the technology and the skills and the perception of the time in dealing with his people, as he has really done very consistently in dealing with his people throughout the ages. In dealing with Abraham, it was altars of stone, but in dealing with the Israelites, it was a bronze altar. There's a transition that takes place in the way that God deals with people in the course of history according to when and where they live and the things that they have available to them. But these kinds of things demonstrate, in fact, that the biblical story is credibly placed, that the story of the Exodus is placed in the right time frame of history according to what we know of things that were going on there. And then there is another story that I want to point out to you, actually a pair of stories. The whole Israelite community in Exodus 16 and 1, when we're just a short while out of Egypt, the whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. Now, almost no matter where Sinai is, they had to be in the Sinai Peninsula at this point in time, somewhere in the Sinai Peninsula. And then in the same chapter, 16 and 13, the Israelites had complained about the idea that they'd come out into the desert to starve, and God said, well, I'm going to give them food. And that evening, quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp, and what formed along with the dew? Manna. This is the beginning of the story of manna. But first God gave them quail in the evening, and this was a promise that he made in the foregoing verses of this chapter. He gave them quail in the evening on that occasion. Now, what time of year was this? Well, this is the second month after they'd come out of Egypt. The first month is the month in which Passover falls on the 14th day, the evening of the 14th day, where they slaughter the Passover lamb, and then they eat that meal and begin the 8 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So what time of year does Passover fall? It's where we have Easter on our calendar, right? That's the time frame of Passover. And so it is late March, early April, as a normal rule. It's generally late March, early April. And so if this is the second month, we've gone 1 month further down the line from Passover, the 15th day of the second month, and so we're into late April or early May. Okay, this is the spring of the year, late April or early May, somewhere in the Sinai Peninsula, that Israel is given quail by God. Now, is quail the same as manna? Manna has no naturalistic explanation whatsoever, and that's a reason to notice the story of the quail. Manna has no naturalistic explanation whatsoever, but quail exists normally. Okay, quail are a normal part of the world environment in which we live, and there's no suggestion that God created the quail out of nothing. That certainly is the suggestion with manna, that this was a process that has no natural equivalent whatsoever, but there's no suggestion at all that God brought the quail into being out of nothing. Rather, that he brought the quail to the Israelites, but the quail had already existed when he brought them to them. Then we go down the line 1 year, Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. On the 20th day of the second month of the second year, we're 1 year later, we're on the 20th day of the second month. Again, the second month, this is late April, early May that we're looking at. The cloud lifted from above the tabernacle of testimony, telling the Israelites they're going to start moving around, they're going to start moving toward Canaan. And just a few verses later, or a short while after this, in Numbers 11:31, where again the Israelites have complained, we're sick of manna, been eating it for a year, we're sick of this manna, that's all we ever get. Can't we have some good old cucumbers and leeks like our wonderful life back in Egypt that we used to live when we were slaves? And so God said, I'm going to give you meat. I'm going to give you meat, and you're going to eat it until you're absolutely sick of it, and it's coming out of your noses. And I think in the storyline, they probably got way too greedy and ate way too much and ate it without adequate preparation and didn't take care to avoid disease issues, but they certainly had a problem with the meat they ate. Nevertheless, God brought them quail. Numbers 11:31 and 32, now a wind went out from the Lord and drove quail in from the sea. It brought them down all around the camp to about 3 feet above the ground, as far as a day's walk in any direction. When do you have quail in that kind of quantity, that kind of vast quantity? When do you have birds in quantities like that, that they would just cover the ground and be piled up when a wind blows them in from the sea? Well, when do you have birds in those kinds of accumulations? When they're migrating. That's right. Do quail migrate? It is a fact that quail do migrate through Sinai twice a year. They fly from further south up to Europe in the spring. When did we have the quail events in both of those stories? In the spring of the year. They fly from the south to the north, going up to Europe in the spring, going through the Suez and Aqaba Gulfs in the evening. That's from Kenneth Kitchen on the reliability of the Old Testament. So this is a very credible story. It's a story that's put in just the right place in just the right time. They're in the right place for the quail. They're not too far away, and they're in vast quantities, and God sends a wind to blow them in from the sea. The sea. Well, yes, they go up through the Suez and Aqaba Gulfs in the evening. When did they show up? In the evening. So the account that's given to us there in Exodus, it would be a very strange thing for an author hundreds of years later to make up something like this. Because what would he know of the ecology in the Sinai Peninsula or the migrations of quail that don't go through Israel, they go through the Sinai. They go around the edge of the Sinai there up the seacoast. What would a writer in Israel, hundreds of years later, some priestly writer trying to make up an epic story of the origin of Israel, and what a strange epic story anyway, picturing the people as so dense and so uncooperative and so slow to catch on to the purposes of God. But nevertheless, why would an author, long, long after the fact, have this kind of an idea to picture God doing this, these two occasions a year apart, in just the right time of the year, the right time of the day, the right mechanism, and so forth? Well, the answer, I believe, is that we have a credible demonstration of the providence of God. God using their natural surroundings, a little supernatural help, a wind to blow them in from the sea, and using the available resources to provide for his people, to give them exactly what they asked for. And sometimes, as has been noted in other contexts, it might not be good to get exactly what you ask for. But God said, I'll give you exactly what you asked for on this second occasion, and you'll be sorry. You'll be sick of it. You won't appreciate it once you've got it. And that is a very credible story. It's a story that makes sense with all that we know of the region and with all that we know of the ecosystem of the region. And it makes no sense at all that someone far removed from that in both time and location would ever have made up such a thing that fits in with the facts that we can know. Circumstantial evidence, proof of facts offered as evidence from which other facts are to be inferred, contrasted with direct evidence, also called indirect evidence. Circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is tremendously important in knowing that things are true. And when we find that the Bible, in place after place, can be checked and verified, not that we found remains of the woman of Thebes or remains of Abimelech, but that the story there is absolutely credible, it's told in a very believable way, and is consistent with all the facts that we are able to check, and likewise with the Exodus story, there are supernatural elements in there that can never be checked. How could you ever find out how the waters of the Red Sea parted? And incidentally, I'm going to just comment on the Red Sea. You know, the words that are used there in the Hebrew do not mean Red Sea. And this is something that will come up from time to time. A more literal rendering would be Sea of Reeds. And so there have been all kinds of speculations about the Israelites passing through some little marsh or something. But whatever it was they passed through, an Egyptian army drowned there. Okay, if you're going to believe the story at all, it's pretty hard to get away from the drowning of the Egyptian army. An Egyptian army drowned in that water, whatever water it was. And you'll find that indeed the word that is used there to describe that body of water, Sea of Reeds, that word reed is used to describe various kinds of plants, including the reeds that Moses' little boat was put among, the little ark that held Moses, he was put among the reeds. But you'll also find that that same word, and this is not often mentioned in this context, is mentioned by Jonah in his experience when he was thrown overboard in the Mediterranean Sea. He talks about being down in the depths of the sea, and he talks about the reeds. It doesn't say reeds, it says weeds in my translation, in the NIV, but it talks about the weeds being wrapped around his head when he was swallowed by this creature that God had prepared to take him in. And that word is the same word. It's the same word, Yam Suf. It's the same word that we have in the Exodus account of the going out from Egypt and crossing the Red Sea. And I would suggest that all that means is the Israelites, when they crossed that body of water, they didn't have a proper name for it, they weren't geographers. When the Israelites crossed that body of water, they either saw reeds along the edge or they saw weeds in that water as they were walking through with a wall of water on either side, and it made a big impression on them. And yeah, they called it the Sea of Weeds, not reeds, weeds, the Sea of Weeds, as they walked through there, because of what they saw, whether on the shore or in that water that stood up in their behalf. But it doesn't tell us anything at all, because there's no proper name of an ancient body of water that can be identified with that. When the Septuagint translators translated Exodus in the 2nd century BC, they understood that place to be the Red Sea, and that's how they rendered it in Greek, and that's how it came to be the Red Sea in our English Bibles, referring either to the Gulf of Suez or the Gulf of Aqaba, referring to one or the other of those legs of water that go up around the Sinai Peninsula. But we can't know with certainty where the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. But we know, if we accept the account at all, and it's a very credible account once again, if you allow for the supernatural, that there was enough water there to destroy an Egyptian army with all of its chariots and charioteers and so forth. Circumstantial evidence. We're going to talk a little bit about the kind of mind frame that has come down to us from the 19th century. It didn't start in the 19th century. In fact, we could talk about the background of what's called higher criticism, what developed into historical criticism, the historical critical method, the dismantling of the Bible and the reassembling of it into various scholarly shapes and forms. We could go back really to the Reformation. One of the unfortunate outcomes, as I would view it, of the Reformation is that we moved from having having royalty that served at the pleasure of a clergy to a clergy that served at the pleasure of royalty. We moved from one kind of church-state situation to another kind of church-state situation, and very few of the nations of Europe had a free church in the years after the Reformation, and for that matter really still do today. You can have churches of all kinds in the democracies of Europe, but really there is a state-sanctioned church, and we want nothing to do with that. We don't want to have any part of anything like that. Rick has made reference to the Nazi control over the clergy of the Lutheran Church in Germany in World War II and what a devastating effect that had. We want nothing to do with anything like that. But along with that control of the clergy, you know, the clergy of the Church of England served at the whim of the King of England, and consequently, the institutions of higher education in which the state-run institutions in which the clergy was trained taught what the state wanted taught. And we tend in that same direction with religious institutions in our own country today, not for the same reasons. But nevertheless, how did the dogma of the 18th and 19th centuries, the idea of evolution, the idea of the development of the biblical text, and all of the related ideas that come into psychology and Marxism and so on down the line, how did those things get so deeply entrenched so quickly? Well, it had to do with this close bonding of church and state that exists in Western Europe, and this close bonding between church, state, and institutions of higher learning. The clergy go through the state-run institutions of higher learning. The state-run institutions of higher learning have bought into the evolutionary concept in all its ramifications, and so the clergy comes out with that as their indoctrination, with what they have been trained to think, and it spreads and it becomes a kind of a core worldview that influences the way that people approach the scripture. In the 19th century, particularly in Germany, the higher critical analysis of the Old Testament documents was made under the assumption that the religion of the Hebrews slowly evolved from polytheism, many gods, to henotheism, one god among many gods, to monotheism, one god, and that all references to supernatural activity in the Bible are spurious. Start at the bottom. This is a basic assumption of the scholars who are Bible critics in one school or another, is that the supernatural just is impossible. If the Bible says a miracle happened, we just take it for granted. That can't be the case. There are a lot of things that we could talk about in that area, including the late dating of the book of Daniel. Daniel is spoken of in a lot of scholarly literature as being written in the 2nd century BC. Why? Why the 2nd century BC? Well, because Daniel describes very accurately things that happened in the 2nd century BC. And if there can be no supernatural activity, there can be no prophecy. And if there can be no prophecy, the only way you can write prophecy is after it's already happened. Therefore, based on that and that alone, in spite of good textual evidence within the book as well as external evidence that supports the book, they move the book of Daniel from the 7th and 6th centuries BC to the 2nd century BC because that's the only way from an evolutionary frame of reference, and there's no accident in using that terminology here, from an evolutionary frame of reference, that's the only way you can explain Daniel's clear prophecies, clear statements about the things that were going to happen up to and through the middle of the 2nd century BC. The other part of this that is worth emphasizing, again, in terms of the analysis of Old Testament documents by scholars, which has become the mainstream perspective on biblical documents among scholars in higher institutions of higher education, is this idea that the religion of the Hebrews slowly evolved. Now, that is a 19th century idea. The whole evolutionary idea was so easy to grab hold of in the 19th century when progress was seen as just inevitable. Everything's just going to get better and better. The technological revolution was underway. We were building better and better machines, doing things faster and more efficiently than ever before, going faster than we ever dreamed possible in previous generations. And that idea of moving to better and better things was applied to sociology, applied to human development, applied to religion. The idea that ancient man must have had very primitive religion indeed, and the consensus was that polytheism was more primitive than monotheism. Do you believe that polytheism is more primitive than monotheism? I don't believe that at all. I believe that man's first religion was monotheism. And when I think about the way the human mind worked, it seems to me that that would be the natural inclination of the first thing you would think of, even apart from Revelation. Why would you think of scads of gods all over the place doing things? It just doesn't seem natural to me. But that develops, and we talked about fish stories a little bit the other day too, in terms of the way myths like the Gilgamesh epic develop over time. The things get embellished as they're told and retold, and people add details that never existed, and people make things sound bigger and grander and more exciting. And I think that's how polytheism develops out of monotheism and not the other way around. I do think that we'd see henotheism, as depicted here, in the Canaanites in the days of the Exodus. That is to say, they believed in El, the God of Abraham, but they didn't believe he was the God. He was just one God among many gods. We find that when Rahab is talking to the spies, her people know about God. They know about El Elohim. They know about God Most High. They know about the mighty God who has brought them out of Egypt. But they don't think he's the only God. He's just part of the pantheon of gods that they believed in, and he's moved from first place to a much lower rung, maybe not last place, but a much lower rung in the thinking of the Canaanites. Religion does not develop in the way depicted here, but as with many things about evolution, whether you're talking about physical evolution or social evolution, the process is very seldom actually challenged and proven. It's assumed that things move from poorer to better, from weaker to stronger, from smaller to bigger, in terms of human thinking as well as in terms of the development of biological life. From a critique of certain uncritical assumptions in modern historiography, that's quite a mouthful of a title, by John Montgomery, talking about the documentary hypothesis, which we're, if you don't even know what I'm talking about, we're going to get to that shortly, and I'll define that hypothesis a little bit better. The notion that the Bible was put together way after the time frame in which it's supposed to have occurred and from a multitude of divergent sources. From the earliest day of systematic higher criticism, the Graf-Kuhnen-Wellhausen documentary hypothesis of the 19th century, which is in the German schools, it has been observed that the higher critics are invariably anti-supernaturalists. And almost all of those from Da Vinci Code on, whatever area you want to talk about, Passover plot, whatever, however far back or however contemporary you want to be with the various things we've talked about, almost all of those who draw conclusions about conspiracies or draw conclusions about disciples making things up long after the fact or whatever else, almost all of them are, when all is said and done, anti-supernaturalists. They just do not believe that God can really do anything in this world, that God can reach into this world and accomplish things. They are constantly attempting, in a reductionist way, to remove the supernatural from the biblical material. The book of Daniel is given late dating, thereby eliminating its prophetic element. The synoptic gospels are dated after the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, and that's how so many have come to the conclusion, even though they don't necessarily understand the presuppositions of their own opinion, so many have come to the conclusion that the gospels were written much later than they really were, is because of the very thing referred to here, changing Jesus' predictions of the fall of Jerusalem into accounts written after it occurred. The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all present to us Jesus saying, this thing is going to be thrown down. The city of Jerusalem is going to be besieged and destroyed. The temple is going to be thrown down, not one stone left upon another. And the only way the anti-supernatural assumptions can be legitimate is if Jesus never said that, and his disciples made it up after the destruction had already occurred. We're going to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. But that's a presumption of the anti-supernaturalists, changing Jesus' predictions into a history written after the fact as though it had been a prediction. In general, the miraculous is explained away by attributing it to later sources or later editors or the elaborations of believing communities. But as with our story of the woman of Thebes, very often, the scholars do not, in fact, have their facts straight when they attribute these things to later writers, later editors, later compilers, or elaborations of believing communities, as it's put here. The method represents the most thoroughgoing application of a naturalistic historicism to the study of the Bible. Naturalistic, no supernatural involved. It assumes that biblical religion in both the Old and New Testaments passed through stages of growth and evolution like all ancient religions, and in this evolution was heavily influenced through interaction with its religious environment. Strange thing is, biblical religion, if it evolved at all, evolved in a different direction, in fact, in an opposite direction of the religions of any people in the ancient world. This method involves the consistent application of the principle of analogy to biblical religion. The history and development of biblical religion must be analogous to the history and development of other ancient religions. That's the presumption. But again, what's that rule out? It rules out any possibility of revelation that God spoke to his people, which the Bible asserts over and over again. God said, this is the word of the Lord. If God is able to speak, then none of these things make any sense at all. This approach stifled the study of biblical theology for an entire generation and resulted in the production of a plethora of books tracing the evolution of biblical religion. But when I say, or when this author says tracing the evolution, what he really means is making up an evolutionary story, because it's not tracing anything that actually ever existed. One of the most popular was Harry Emerson Fosdick's A Guide to the Understanding of the Bible in 1938. The method of comparative religions was motivated by certain philosophical presuppositions about the nature of history and religion. Presuppositions are very important in this context, particularly the presuppositions of evolution and natural historical development. Had it not been for the theory of evolution, there would have been no Marxism, there would have been no historical critical analysis of the Bible, there would have been no Freudian psychology either, and that would deserve a lot more discussion than I'm going to have time to deal with. But a lot of the things that are part of the worldview of the culture that we are in have to do with the basic original philosophical presuppositions of evolution, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, things moving through competition to a better and better situation. In this sense, that analysis was anti-revelatory and anti-theological. Revelation and theology belong to the realms of philosophy and dogma, not history. The history of the Hebrew Christian religion cannot embody absolute truth. That's the assumption. That's not what I'm saying. The history of the Hebrew Christian religion cannot embody absolute truth, but must be a development resulting from the religious genius of the Hebrews in interaction with their religious environment. Now, is this some ancient idea, some old idea, 150 years old, that the Judeo-Christian the Judeo-Christian religion cannot embody absolute truth? That's right where we are today. This has gone from the ranks of academic speculation into mainstream thought in terms of the kinds of articles, the kinds of books and movies that we've been talking about over the past several days. This is totally mainstream now, even though a lot of people believe very contradictory things about it. ABC TV can very easily talk about the Bible in a naturalistic way and totally ignore the possibility of revelation, and whether if Jesus was raised from the dead, whether all that stuff about Mary Magdalene would matter in the slightest anyway. If he raised from the dead, if the miracle is true, then what is the relevance of all that speculation and supposition about conflict and difficulty in those early days? The critics' assumption that variations in literary style can provide a reliable guide to authorship has proved false again and again. Have you ever read a book and noticed that the author's style changes from the beginning to the end of the book? Or read two books by the same author and realized that his style has changed from one book to the other? That happens with great regularity. That's a normal part of writing. It's a normal part of growing. It's a normal part of gaining confidence and various other things in terms of the expression of writing. But there's an assumption that's brought to bear in handling the Bible that says if you see changes in literary style, it probably means there were different editors and different authors involved. In some cases there were. We'll talk about that tomorrow as well. But that presumption is carried much, much too far in terms of biblical analysis. Part two of Goethe-Faust differs radically in both style and literary purpose from part one. But the two parts were not written by two different authors. This is how the book of Isaiah is handled, for example, by scholars. Isaiah cannot have been a product of one author in the 8th century BC, because Isaiah chapters 1 through 39 is quite different than Isaiah chapters 40 through 66. It's very, very different. Therefore, a second Isaiah, this is the premise, a second Isaiah must have written the latter part, and besides that, it reflects prophecies that couldn't possibly be prophecies like the coming of Cyrus. That would have to be miraculous if it was written in the 8th century, but if it isn't written until sometime in the 5th century, then it's no longer a difficulty, and so we end up with this sort of conclusion, again, throwing out the possibility of the supernatural. The Merchant of Venice contains the loftiest poetry intermingled with whole scenes, baldly prosaic, devoid of rhythm, vulgar in diction, yet one author, Shakespeare, wrote the entire play. C.S. Lewis, one of the most eminent literary scholars of our time, well demonstrated in his essay, Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism, that the presuppositions of higher criticism are hopelessly subjectivistic, and they are. These kinds of analysis, the kinds of things that I've been sharing with you from the standpoint of the media and scholarship, are very subjective, based on one's own interpretation, one's own presuppositions, one's own analysis, rather than on facts. Its application overwhelmingly dubious even in the realms of modern and contemporary literature. German theologian Gerhard Mayer has produced an even more systematic critique titled appropriately, The End of the Historical Critical Method. One of the things that I've noticed about scholars that I admire in terms of archaeology and biblical research is that they speak in terms of the end of the historical critical method, but they're talking about it at the very time when it has really mainstreamed as far as the kinds of things that are being said and written because of the Jesus Seminar and some other forces that have been at work in the 1990s, some feminist forces and other things that have been brought to bear. The presuppositional and logical failings of higher criticism betray a fundamental intellectual difficulty inherent in the method, whether it is applied to the Bible in particular or to historical or literary works in general. Thus, the higher critical attempt to determine authorship by literary style brought Ugaritic studies to the verge of chaos. And my professor of classics, I didn't have his professor of classics, but I heard the same thing. My professor of classics at Cornell University in the 1950s observed wryly that after 75 years of that sort of thing in Homeric scholarship, we have finally jettisoned that approach and have concluded that if Homer didn't write the Odyssey, it was written by someone of the same name who lived about the same time. And likewise, if Moses didn't write the Pentateuch, it was written, as he says, by someone of the same name who lived in the same time and wrote with the same authority. We'll pick that up again tomorrow and talk more about the faulty assumptions that have brought us to the place we are in terms of popular scholarship dealing with the Bible. You have a break.